This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, author Dan Brown in a benefit performance for the writers on a New England stage series. With 200 million copies of his novels in print in 52 languages, Brown is one of the world's best-selling writers. The blockbuster thrillers Angels and Demons and The Da Vinci Code have also inspired passionate fans and Hollywood movies.
Symbols are a language that can help us understand our past.
A murder that hides a message.
He did this himself in his own blood?
Is it possible?
A code.
This is a message. Your grandfather left you.
He left us.
Only he can break.
Professor Harry.
Demons, omens, codes, monks. Da Vinci.
Dan Brown grew up in New Hampshire, and as he took the stage at the Music Hall to talk about how his life was transformed by the success of The Da Vinci Code, he first acknowledged the people who helped get him there.
I want to welcome two very special celebrity guests in the audience tonight. With us tonight are my two favorite authors in the whole world. One has written over a dozen internationally best-selling textbooks, and the other is the author of two fascinating histories, as well as being a master scholar of sacred music. Ladies and gentlemen, my mom and dad. Thanks for making the trip. My parents are both writers, musicians, very creative people, and they encouraged their three children to be the same. When I was 5 years old, my mother helped me write and publish my first book. I dictated, she transcribed, we did a print run of one, bound in cardboard with a yarn binding, and Mom, I still have it. Here it is. Okay. I titled this thriller, The Giraffe, The Pig, and The Pants on Fire. As the title suggests, it was a blend of Orwellian allegory and the surrealism of Borges. And for the next half hour, I really thought I'd just do a dramatic reading. So, I would not submit you to that. I invited my parents to join us tonight so I could take a moment and publicly recognize all the incredible support they've given to me over the years, and also to publicly apologize to them for a couple of things. Last week, I found a school photo of myself in sixth grade. I am so sorry. I know I insisted on that Dutch boy haircut. What I did not know, and what I recently learned from one of your loose-lipped friends, was that for 2 years, people thought I was your daughter. So, I'm very sorry about that. While I'm offering apologies, Mom, I recently bumped into our old church minister from Exeter. He reminded me of an unfortunate incident at the communion rail when I was 10. But in my defense, what 10-year-old, kneeling at a communion rail, would not have collapsed in hysterics and spit out his wine when the prim and proper lady kneeling next to him suddenly broke wind? I am indeed truly remorseful for all the different ways I've embarrassed my parents. And yet, I think it's only fair to remind them that parent-child embarrassment is a two-way street. Dad, my Dutch boy haircut was no worse than the comb-over you had in the 80s. And Mom, that prim and proper lady kneeling next to me at the communion rail was you. So. On the day that I published The Giraffe, The Pig, and The Pants on Fire, I knew I was hooked. I loved writing stories. I wrote nonstop in elementary school, at Phillips Exeter, at college, and I feel very fortunate to have been able to continue writing later in life. My favorite stories to write nowadays are those that challenge long-held beliefs. There was this one I wrote called The Da Vinci Code. I actually always wondered how my mom felt when she read that review that said Dan Brown is a heretic fit for the stake. So we avoided bonfires in my family for like 3 years. Even today, strangers will come up and ask me, what happened to you? Did God not answer some childhood prayer? Did your priest drop you on your head during your baptism? And I hate to admit it here in mixed company, but the blame for my heresy falls squarely on the shoulders of my parents. Unfortunately, I grew up the son of a church organist and a math teacher. Yeah, I was lost from day one. When I was growing up, my mom was not only a church organist, she was the church choir director, which meant there was no escaping Sunday morning church services. Now, I didn't mind it. I liked the music, I liked the people, and I really liked the free donuts. But as a kid, all those hours in the house of God had a powerful effect on me. Church is potent stuff. Thundering pipe organs, the exotic smell of incense, passionate sermons, the tolling of huge bells, and the magic of a candlelight Christmas pageant. Not to mention, in my case, seeing my own mom stand up and conduct a huge congregation as they sang out, "A mighty fortress is our God. Onward, Christian soldiers." So this reassuring and joyful world became my reality as a kid, and it never dawned on me to question any of it. The virgin birth, Noah's Ark, Moses receiving the Ten Commandments, the resurrection, it was all fact. It had to be. All the adults in the room agreed it was true, including my own mom. Concurrent with my mother's religious influence, I had my dad, who was equally attentive and enthusiastic about his passions and belief, which were more scientific in nature. My father, a math teacher at Phillips Exeter, as well as a math textbook author, also revered the beauty and majesty of the world around him, but he tended to see it through a slightly different lens. When I was a kid, he would take me out at night and we'd look up at the billions of stars in heaven and we'd talk about space, the universe, and the concept of infinity. Infinity, he and I agreed, was impossible to imagine. And yet, if the universe were not infinite, then what did the edge of the universe look like? Was it a big brick wall in space? Was it a sign that said nothing beyond this point? These were the kinds of things that kept me up as a kid. Whenever there was a lunar eclipse, my dad would prep me for it by pulling out a soccer ball, a tennis ball, and a flashlight, and reenacting the Earth moving between the sun and the moon, casting a shadow. At dinner time, baby carrots were an opportunity to teach us about conic sections. And I actually learned that depending on how you cut your carrot, you could create a cross-section that was a circle, an ellipse, a parabola, or the holy grail of all dinnertime carrot cuts, the hyperbola. Okay. I achieved that only once. The trick is just to parboil the carrots. Don't let them get too mushy. And we did not go out for pizza very often. But when we did, my dad would gather us around the big pizza pie, and he would teach us about the degrees of arc, diameters, and areas of circles. And I cannot tell you how mortifying it was to stand in line at Romeo's Pizza with my dad, with his big Texas Instrument calculator. You know the ones that were this big when they first came out? While he carefully calculated whether it was more cost-effective to buy a large pizza, two smalls, a large and a medium, freeze the leftovers, you know. And all of this from the same guy who wrote Advanced Mathematics. So when I was a kid, in our garage, there was a bright red Volvo with the license plate Kyrie, parked beside a white minivan with the license plate Metric. This age-old battle between science and religion squaring off right there next to my little blue Schwinn. I was quite happy in these two worlds of science and religion, but once I matured to the all-knowing age of 13, I started to realize that these two different worlds posed all kinds of contradictions. The Bible said God created the universe in 7 days, but in school I just learned about the Big Bang. The Bible said God made Adam and Eve and all the animals, but I'd just been to the Boston Museum of Science and learned about evolution. And so I asked a priest how I could reconcile these inconsistencies. Essentially, I asked him, which story is true? And this particular priest replied to me, "Nice boys don't ask that question." So at that point, I was pretty dejected and confused. I wasn't sure which way to turn. Where science offered exciting proof of its claims, photos, equations, visible evidence, religion was much more demanding. It constantly wanted me to accept everything on faith. And faith, I found, was a difficult proposition in an imperfect world. So in high school and college, I gravitated toward the solid foundations of science. But over the years, as my studies in science continued, I discovered that the further one progressed into solid science, the mushier the ground started to get. When science starts tackling the tough questions, it starts using phrases like uncertainty principle, margin for error, theory of relativity. Slowly, physics turns into metaphysics, numbers become imaginary numbers, and even matter itself comes into question. And it's interesting to note that particle physicists now believe that matter, everything around us, really is just trapped energy. That this podium, for example, is nothing but pure energy trapped in the form of a podium. That each one of us in this room is nothing but pure energy manifesting itself in the shape of a human being. And I'll add that these same physicists who proclaim that everything is energy are now quietly asking if it is merely coincidence that the vast majority of religious texts, including the Bible, describe God as energy and describe God as being all around us.
You're listening to author Dan Brown in a special benefit performance for the Writers on a New England Stage series. The event was recorded live at the Portsmouth Music Hall.
We live in an exciting era. Right now, for the first time in history, the line between science and religion is starting to blur. Physicists exploring the subatomic level are suddenly witnessing the interconnectivity of all things and having religious experiences. Buddhist monks are reading physics books and learning about experiments that confirm what they have believed in their hearts for centuries but have been unable to quantify. What I have finally come to accept is that science and religion are partners. They are simply two different languages attempting to tell the same story. Both are manifestations of man's quest to understand the divine. While science dwells on the answers, religion savors the questions. For me personally, there is no experience that better illustrates this overlapping mystery of science and religion than that of lying out beneath a star-filled infinite universe and staring up at the heavens. Regardless of our particular religious beliefs or even lack thereof, I'm imagining we've all had one of those private moments where we stare up at the starlit heavens and we say, whatever that is, it's bigger than my understanding. It's beyond my grasp. And in that instant, we sense God, whatever that may be for each of us. Faith, and this is every faith, is a continuum. And we each fall on that line wherever we fall. By attempting to rigidly classify ethereal concepts like belief and devotion, we end up debating semantics to the point where we entirely miss the obvious. That is, that religion, all religions, have at their core the quest to decipher life's big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? And what happens when we die? Thousands of years ago, mankind had an extensive pantheon of gods and goddesses to explain just about everything that was beyond his understanding: earthquakes, infertility, thunder, even love. The ebb and flow of the ocean was attributed to the shifting moods of Poseidon. Infertility was caused by falling out of favor with the goddess Juno. Pandemic disease was a punishment, a plague sent by an angry god. And thunderstorms were caused by Thor throwing lightning bolts. This kind of spirituality is known as the God of the Gaps. When the ancients experienced gaps in their understanding of the world around them, they filled those gaps with God. Over time, however, the progress of science began removing those gaps, and the pantheon of gods started to shrink. So in light of science's steady march forward, one might expect that our need for God should be decreasing. But in fact, if we look at the strength of world religion today, we see this is not the case. Our need for God has not decreased at all. In fact, it has increased and it has evolved. We no longer turn to God for answers as to why the skies drop hail or why plagues spread. Science has answered those questions for us. We turn to God for the answers to a handful of questions that science has never been able to answer. Why are we here? What does it all mean? Is death the end, or is there something beyond that? And in asking these questions, we realize that we, just like our ancient ancestors, still worship the God of the gaps. And whether this human need to believe in something is a random evolutionary trait, or whether God created the human mind in a way to make us believe in God, is an interesting debate. But either way, one thing seems clear. We, as spiritual beings, face a growing dilemma. Our biggest challenge now seems to be that our brains are evolving. We have a much greater understanding of the world around us, and we're less able to blindly accept ancient beliefs without questioning, even if we desperately want to. How do we read the story of Adam and Eve in the face of evolutionary science? How do we read the book of Genesis alongside with a modern cosmology textbook? New advances in technology present us with impossible ethical dilemmas. We can now manipulate human stem cells, and we must ask ourselves, which is more reprehensible to God, harvesting fetal tissue or failing to use our God-given intellect to find new ways to fight disease? And there are valid arguments on both sides. We've reached a point in human development when we must ask ourselves, how do we, as a modern science-minded people, not lose our faith? This very point was addressed by the Vatican's Carmelengo in a speech to the College of Cardinals. Not in real life, unfortunately, but rather in the first draft of a novel I wrote called Angels and Demons. I wish it had been in real life. The Carmelengo, standing before the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel, speaks on this age-old battle between science and religion. And I'm just going to read a very short section to you. My brothers, science proclaims that our world is a meaningless speck in the grand scheme, and that life is some kind of cosmic accident. Science tells us we exist merely by chance, because Earth happens to be just the right distance from just the right star, with just the right blend of certain elements. Science tells us that humankind is nothing but the lucky winner of a mindless process called evolution, a cold, self-serving progression that combines and recombines genetic material over time. Astrophysicists tell us that even the slightest change in the force of gravity would have rendered a much different universe. If the gravitational constant had been a fraction stronger, our universe would have collapsed in on itself. If it had been a fraction weaker, our universe would have dissipated into an endless amorphous cloud of dust. But brothers, the gravitational constant was precisely what it needed to be to create our magnificent sea of heavenly bodies. And yet somehow, science fails to see God's hand in this? Is it really so much easier to believe that we simply chose the right card from an infinite deck? Have we become so spiritually bankrupt that we'd rather believe in mathematical implausibility than in a power greater than ourselves? My wife Blythe and I have always enjoyed traveling, and as part of the research for one of my books, we traveled to London and visited the British Museum, specifically to see a selection of their Sumerian tablets. These tablets, written in cuneiform some 2,500 years before Christ, contain stories that, to me, sounded strangely familiar. One bore a tale about a goddess who was crucified, died, and resurrected on the third day. Another, a story of a great flood sent by the gods to punish non-believers. Another, a story of a god who created a beautiful garden for two humans, but warned them not to taste the garden's fruit. In this original version, and this is really for the ladies in the audience, the person responsible for tasting the apple and the eventual fall of man was not Eve. It was not even a woman. So apparently, ladies, this whole mess is our fault. And we as men are sorry, as always. In light of these familiar stories in the Sumerian tablets, I began looking more closely at all the elements of my faith, including its symbols. And it became clear to me that the very little of my childhood religion was unique or original. Christian symbology overflows with images that long predate Christ. The halos hovering over the heads of the Catholic saints derive from the Egyptian sun disks, symbolizing royalty and the eternal soul. The recurring images of the Virgin Mary holding baby Jesus derive from pictograms of Isis cradling her miraculously conceived son, Horus. And on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, the face of God himself, an old man with a flowing white beard, bears a striking resemblance to Zeus, the god of all gods. Even the Christian ritual of communion comes from the god-eating rites of much earlier pagan religions. In fact, it turns out there were more than a dozen dying and rising gods long before Jesus Christ, many of whom were born on December 25th. Much to my surprise, it appeared the stories I was taught in Sunday school had not magically appeared in some big bang of faith. Christianity had evolved, as had every other religion on earth, borrowing from religions before it. Now, this idea was exciting to me. It almost felt like a new access point to faith had just opened. And eager to spend more time with these ideas and explore them further, I wrote a novel called The Da Vinci Code, in which fictional characters debated some of these topics and offered up their own theories and ideas, arguing over alleged contradictions in the scripture, leaps of logic in the Jesus story, possible evidence of alternative histories, and in the end, asking the question, what does it mean to Christianity if Christ is not literally the Son of God? What does it mean if he is in fact more like us, less way up there and more right down here? Now, as you recall, not everyone thought this was a great question to be asking.
Author Dan Brown recorded live at the Portsmouth Music Hall at a special event to benefit the Writers on a New England Stage series. We'll be back with more, including what life is like after the phenomenally successful Da Vinci Code novel. Stay with us for more Dan Brown when Writers on a New England Stage continues on Word of Mouth.